both sides.
But the plain meaning rule has an exception. When using the plain meaning rule would create an absurd result, courts should depart from the plain meaning. It is absurd to say this company is in its rights to fire him because he made the choice of possibly dying from freezing to death or causing other people to die possibly by driving an unsafe vehicle. That's absurd. Now, I had a career in identifying absurdity. And I know it when I see it. And it makes me, you know, it makes me question your judgment.
And that was Al Franken. He's the Democratic senator from Minnesota. And it's his response to the then Supreme Court nominee, Judge Neil Gorsuch, and his dissent ruling while on the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals on the infamous frozen trucker case. Well, welcome to Play Talk. We are broadcasting from the English Department podcast studio at John Jay College. I am Alan Winson, teaching in media and film studies at the college, and it is April 25th, 2017. We are in the Trump era, everybody, a drain-the-swamp moment that is controlled by a burnished, crowned leader who had promised to get rid of the old boy control of the government and then nominated the extremely wealthy and leaders of Wall Street, few of whom had any experience running a government, running the United States, probably the most complex organizational structure ever created by humankind. Well, a new play is going its rounds in city theaters called American Scoreboard. It explores this political moment by reenacting congressional nomination hearings using the transcripts from those hearings. With me today is the creator-producers of the play, Fran Kermser and Chris Burney, and two of its actors, Tracy Swain and Sapna Parikh. And I welcome you all to John Jay and to Radio 568. And I think we'll get started today talking about the American Scoreboard by first getting to know your the creator and producers. And we'll talk to Fran first. So, Fran, how you doing?
I'm well, Alan. How are you?
I'm very good.
Thanks so much for having us on.
Hey, we're gonna have fun. It's gonna be a blast. What I wanted to ask was a little bit about your background. You are the producer and you're co-directing with Chris this play and reading, and we'll talk about the play in a second. You started as a dancer, I understand.
I did. I started as a dancer, and like so many dancers, I was injured and started working on the other side of the stage. That's what brought me to producing. So in working all the different things that one works to get material to the stage, I began producing downtown in New York City, small productions, and kept working on them until eventually I started producing on Broadway. I also grew up with a grandfather who was fiercely interested in politics. He was a newsman. And so this project is of particular interest to me because of that. We all carry those things from our childhood to our adult life.
I think that's what kind of attracted me to this whole thing when I talked to my good friend Sabura Rashid, who had seen the play, and she recommended it. Actually, a reading. This is a reading. It's not a full-blown play.
It's a reading series.
Right, and it's a series, and we will get to that. You are connected with an organization called Manhattan Theater Source, and I saw a quote from your bio. No? It said, a theater and playground for passion in Greenwich Village.
Yes, Manhattan Theater Source ran for 12 years in the village, and it actually is much like the venues that we've been running American Scoreboard in. We've been at a theater downtown called HB Studios, Bank Street Theater, which is very much like Manhattan Theater Source, and these theaters downtown are so electric and so exciting to be in because they're intimate. And you're right there with the actors having this incredible journey with them.
We have so many theaters in New York City that are like that. These small theaters, and you're like the actor is almost in your lap.
Yes.
And it's such a thrill to experience that.
It is. And it's one of the reasons why this is so exciting. This project is so exciting because you get this material that is shaping our future. You are with senators, our government leaders who are shaping our future in these intimate spaces where all of our technology is off. You know, we spend so much time behind our phone.
Right?
Right. And so this
constantly have to tell my students, turn off your screens.
Yes, yes. So this is an opportunity to do that and really take this ride.
Right. It seems like you've been doing this kind of work because there was another project I noticed called the Biography Project.
Yes,
Is kind of looking at, well, you tell us about it.
Yeah, I actually have had a career of really looking at real people's lives. It's really what captivates me the most as a producer, that kind of material, looking at somebody's lives, why they make the choices that they make. And the Biography Project was a series of artist stories that helped to better archive their lives and their work and the work that they made at different stages of their lives. And what's so fantastic about American Scoreboard is that not only do we get a chance to be introduced to these senators, you know, so many of them we know so well. We know Elizabeth Warren. We know Rubio. We know Sanders. But there are so many senators that we don't know. And this really gives us a chance to get to know them. And we get to go to work with them because we enter into each reading being smack dab in the middle of a hearing. So we're with them at their workplace. And it's fascinating.
And you're in their voice, too. You're in their head because these are their words. But we will get to that. I also noticed that you had worked for the New York Foundation of the Arts on the funding panel, and it drew my attention because my wife and I are in film, and we went to the New York Foundation to get some funding. Not funding, but to store our money. So are you still with them? Do you still on that funding panel?
Occasionally for them and many service organizations throughout the city, I serve as a panelist. I also do a lot of teaching revolving around fundraising, and it certainly is an interesting time right now in this administration in that regard. Mm-hmm. You know, we've seen the stories of the NEA and this administration's position to shut the NEA.
Close down PBS.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's hurting our arts for sure.
Yeah, well, I think and the arts, it is who we are. It's
a
reflection of who we are, and I don't think our conservative politicians realize the importance of the arts in the American life. And so, congratulations, and I hope we're not taken out. Chris Burney, let's talk to you a little bit.
Sure.
You are also a creator and producer of the American Scoreboard. And right now you're the assistant to the director of musical theater at the Lincoln Center Theater.
Oh.
What's that job like?
Oh, interesting. No. That was a while ago.
Okay.
My career trajectory, like Fran's, is very interesting. I started on the other side of the stage. I was actually a musical director, an accompanist, a vocal coach. And after many years spent in the pit, I decided to get into the thick of it behind the scenes. So my first job was at Lincoln Center Theater developing musicals and kind of got to work with all of my idols at the time. And
well, drop a name.
Oh, Stephen Sondheim, Lynn Aaron, Stephen Flaherty, Bill Finn. It was a really golden time
And what did you work on with Sondheim?
We worked on the development of his musical Passion.
Mm.
But, you know, the thing that's interesting is through all of the work in art at Lincoln Center, which is obviously a big institution, and now continuing with other organizations, I've been very taken by how we as artists can use our art to speak to many different audiences on many different topics and how we can engage those stories in the issues that matter to us right now.
Right. Is there any music in American Scoreboard?
No, there's not, unless you count the music of many of our politicians and the words they use. Some of these senators are really quite remarkable in the way that they deliver text.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been really fascinating through this process to watch such gifted actors who are in many ways very different from the senators they are reading, be able to bring the musicality of their words to vivid life in these stages in New York.
Do you find that when you are directing the actors, you listen to the musicality of their voices? Is that part of, do you bring that training to the directing?
I've always found that my work developing and producing plays has been about focusing on the tonality of language. I think a lot of times in America, we discount the beauty of the words that our greatest playwrights have used. But I would put up the work of, say, August Wilson, and I worked on his play, Jitney, originally. The language of his words against the words of some of the great people of history from theater. And I feel the same way, ironically, when we look at these congressional hearing transcripts as well. These are very clearly politicians, but they're also people who are aware of the power of the words that they are using.
And they know these words are going to be broadcast. They know these words are going to be not just read, they're going to be heard.
Absolutely. And I think they want them to be heard. One of the great things about our language is how intonation can affect meaning and how context can define content. And I think they're very aware of the words that they are choosing in any given moment.
What this makes me thinking is like we're almost in a Shakespearean moment in which the language is not read, it's heard. And that's how Shakespeare was disseminated, was through the sound.
Absolutely. The greatest texts of our culture, of our species, have been disseminated through the oral tradition. And I think that's true of the words that we are capturing today through this series.
How did you and Fran get together?
Ah.
Fran, you want to field that one?
No, you go ahead.
So it's interesting, you know, Fran, as she said, was a dancer and I was a musician. And there was a point very early in our careers where we were put together by a good friend to collaborate on a new musical. Fran is a choreographer, me as a director. I think we both learned that while we didn't want to continue to create musicals in that way, we wanted to keep creating work together.
Yes, absolutely. And what happened was during the election, I found myself, like so many, so confused and so frustrated, not being able to get the information that I wanted and needed about each candidate and the issues on the table and what their stance was on the issues. And so I began, you know, fiercely reading everything I could get my hands on and eventually ended up binge watching C-SPAN and really just found it so compelling. I mean, you have Republicans believing so fiercely in what they feel the direction of the country should be in, and Democrats feeling so equally as strongly about where they think the country should be led, and they're pit head to head. And these hearings are riveting because there are opening statements, and thereafter there are only 5-minute slots that each senator gets to make their point and ask their questions and dig for their information. So it's great theater. It is great theater. And so I thought, oh, as a mother of a 12-year-old and a producer by trade and just a concerned citizen, we have to get this on stage. And I called Chris.
And, you know, one of the things that really defines my journey, and I think as well as Fran's, I'm the child of two public school teachers. Mm. And so education has always been very important to me. So Fran and I found ourselves after the election commiserating together about the country. And as we pieced through it, beyond even the outcome of the election, we were mourning the loss of sharing of information, an adherence to facts. Where is truth? And as the child of two teachers, I became very distressed, worried about how do we share this information? How can we get the truth out to citizens, to everyone? And through that process, we started talking about what would become American Scoreboard.
This is Radio 568. We are broadcasting from John Jay College. I'm Alan Winston. We're talking to the producers and creators of American Scoreboard and the actors who have performing in the readings of that play. When I was experiencing or living through the moments of the election night, and I think we all remember that night, there's a few things you remember. I remember, you know, when Kennedy was killed, and I was around then, and I think I'll always remember the election night of when Donald Trump was elected president. And And when it became kind of obvious that he was going to be elected, I mean, it was unbelievable because we knew Hillary was going to be elected. We just knew it. And at about 8:30, I went into my studio at home because I have a radio studio at home, and I started broadcasting. And I called all over the country and I said, tell me something good. I'm feeling really low. And I even called my brother-in-law, who was a Trump supporter, and he said, look, get over it. That didn't make me feel any better. No. And then for the next 4 weeks, I went on air almost every night from 8 to 9 for hashtag no news media for now, calling all over the country and asking people, tell me what's going on, because unlike you, Fran, I stopped looking at the news. For 4 weeks, I did not look at the news. I just couldn't take it. I couldn't look at the man's face. I just couldn't take it. If you look at a poster, I actually a poster I put up the in the studio, the cover of the New York Times for the next day when Trump was elected, and you'll notice I covered his face. I just can't do it. This is me. I'm limited.
And I think a lot of people after the election did stop tuning into the news, tuning into their social media feeds. And I think part of it was just, as many people were feeling, just the results of what had happened. But I think it's also raised the question of, as you said, everyone felt Hillary was going to win. The media told us Hillary was going to win, and that's not what happened. So at that point, why are we listening? Who are we listening to? And again, that's why Fran and I really wanted to start this series.
Yeah. Start that communication again. Right.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
I think that's one of the great things that can come out of this time, truly. I mean, it is. It's a very challenging time. I do think I know people who tuned out right after the election. I also know people who tuned in more, you know. And I think now we certainly all are paying attention. And I think, you know, with that, some great things can come of this time.
Yeah. I teach a media class, and usually I teach general media, but this semester I just taught news media. Mm-hmm. I just taught news media. Let's talk to our actors. Tracy.
Yes.
Tracy Shane.
Shane, yes.
Yes, you that's S-H-A-Y-N-E. S-H-A-Y-N-E, if you want to look up any reviews, Tracy Shane.
Oh, goodness.
You play, all great. I guess one of the roles you play is Senator Elizabeth Warren. Yes?
I'm currently playing Elizabeth Warren in as we go through this process.
Okay, all right. Yes. All right, and I want to get into the process because I'm getting the idea we don't have a set play here.
Not yet.
And maybe you never will. But you're also a full-fledged Broadway actress.
Yes.
You've been on Broadway.
I've been on Broadway.
I'm thrilled.
Thank you.
Let's talk about your credits.
Oh, goodness. Okay.
All right, what do you want to talk about? I mean, I have a list here if you need to be reminded. So actors usually don't have to be reminded of their credits.
I know. You usually ask an actor how they are, and they'll tell you their entire resume.
Yeah, I've got some reviews you can look at.
Oh.
You know, from Fantastics, right? The old actor.
Oh.
He always carried around his reviews with him.
Yes,
yeah. So you were in, I just have the list here from your Chicago.
I was, yes. Phantom. I played Roxy in Chicago, and I had a nice long run playing Christine and Phantom of the Opera on Broadway.
Right.
I was in Les Miserables. I was the first replacement. Judy Kuhn was the original Cosette, and then I came in and replaced her in the late 80s. And my first show was A Chorus Line.
Wow.
At the Schubert Theater. I was there for many years.
I was also going to say you don't look that old, but you don't.
Thank you. That's because I went into the show when I was 12. No.
Ah, okay. There you go.
I am that old.
So. That would still make you old, you know.
Yeah, it would.
So that's great. What is it like to... all right, let's go back. You're stepping on a Broadway stage for the first time. You've never been on it before. Do you remember what stage that was?
Yes, the Schubert Theater.
Wow. Is the Schubert still there?
The Schubert is still there.
Okay, all right. Because I remember when the Marriott went up, there was one of them was taken down.
I don't know which one that was.
So you're stepping on the stage of the Schubert Theater. Mm-hmm. You're there for an audition or...
No, actually, I had my first show, A Chorus Line, I auditioned. I was visiting my folks in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I was there. And while I was there, the international tour was out, and it was they were stopping in Columbus, Ohio, and a friend of mine was in it, and they were having auditions. Michael Bennett and his associate, Bob Avian, were coming to hold some auditions, and my friend Bill Hastings said, get yourself here right now. I got on a bus, traveled 3 hours to Columbus, auditioned, and on a Friday, by Monday, they sent me home to get a trunk, and by Monday, I was on the road. And I was on
the actor's trunk.
The actor's trunk. I was on the road for a year, and then I came to, I went on tour for 2 years, and then I came to Broadway. So I moved back to New York City to go right into the show on Broadway.
And this is Chorus Line.
That was a Chorus Line, yeah.
A Chorus Line, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so when you stepped on the Schubert stage for the first time, was that different or was it like any other stage you've ever been on?
That's a great question.
I mean, what did it have the patina and the quality of Broadway that kind of like ran through your body like electricity? No.
You know, I'm going to be honest.
Yeah, please.
I think today I have that kind of excitement and gratitude that you're expressing about, you know, that excitement. But at the time, I was just doing a show. I was just doing my work.
Yeah. After all, you were only 12 years old.
Exactly. Only 12. No, I was about 18, 18 and a half, 19. So I don't think I really appreciated what I had. It's been many years in the making of me really appreciating my career.
Mm-hmm.
So now when I step onto a Broadway stage, it's thrilling.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely thrilling.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, early experiences are wasted on the young.
True.
You have nothing to compare it to. It's like, you know, it's like everything else. Sapna Parikh, you are not an actress, per se. I mean, you're acting now, so in a sense, you're an actress. But it's not really where you started.
Actually, that is where I started.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah, it's funny because it actually, I guess it's come full circle in some ways.
Mm-hmm. All right,
it's kind of been a crazy journey, ironically.
Let's talk about the in-between part.
Okay.
Because you're a journalist.
Yes.
I was so impressed of all the stuff you've done. You're so young. I didn't know quite where to start, but tell us about your career. You were also in the medical field.
Mm-hmm.
But let's talk about your journalism, because I'm really interested in that. How did you get started into journalism? Why did you get started there?
I got started in journalism here in New York. I was here actually after finishing medical school and was doing surgery residency and missed the whole creative side.
Were you doing that residency as a nurse or as a...
No, as a doctor.
A doctor.
Yeah.
You have a medical degree.
Right. Yeah. Well,
but you don't practice medicine?
At the moment, no.
Okay. But so you could.
I could. Yes.
I've
my
got
license
this
is still
feeling
active.
In the back of my neck.
I keep it active.
Okay. I'm being silly. So you were doing residency, getting ready to be a doctor, and then you decided not to become a doctor. So what was that decision?
Well, so I actually finished and I became a doctor and came out here and was actually training in surgery after medical school. So I had graduated and finished and had my license and my career actually started in theater. I was a singer and a dancer before that and had come to New York first to audition for cruise ships. That was sort of like the next step on that pathway.
Clearly you were very young at that time.
Right. Yes, I was 12 too.
You
yeah.
were 12.
Just like Therese.
A teenager, right.
But I sort of missed that whole creative side and wanted to see how can I put this together. And I grew up, we watched the news every day. I loved the news. We watched it before dinner every day, before we sat down for dinner. And I sort of fell into this, but I was looking, and ended up meeting the news director for the local CBS station, and she had me do a cold read, and sort of accidentally got the job. But I reached out.
That this kind of waking up to the fact that you maybe wanted to move away from medicine into the arts?
It was kind of a process because I started in the arts and missed that creative side, but I loved what I was doing, so I wanted to see how I could combine that. I guess it was a process over a couple of years.
Am I kind of weird in the fact that I find this so unusual and strange and wonderful?
No, I appreciate that. I know this whole background has kind of been weird. Since then, I've actually shifted from doing medical fitness and health reporting. I've been doing general news and breaking news and political news for
right.
the last
And who have you worked for over the years in journalism?
In journalism, I started at WCBS, which is the local New York City CBS station, and then Fox News, and then ABC News, and then now I actually work for Sirius XM.
And what do you
cover
do for,
headline
what do you do for
news.
Them?
They have a headline news channel, Channel 115, and I'm their breaking news and political news reporter.
Oh, so you're on mic?
Yeah.
Oh.
So for the first time, I'm doing radio for the last 2 years.
So you've been doing this, you know this, okay.
No, it's still fun, and I'm still learning every day, so
This is a little bit different. So we can hear you on Sirius Radio on Headline News.
Yes, Channel 115.
Great. I was very interested in this, and maybe you can just talk a little bit about it. I know it has nothing to do with American Scoreboard, but I'm curious. And this is my program, so I can do what I want to do. That you are also a scuba diver, and that you were on the Aquarius with NASA astronauts.
Yes, this was...
Can you talk about that and what the Aquarius is?
Aquarius is an underwater laboratory where NASA trains their astronauts. It's at it's off the coast of Key Largo, and it's at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. It's about 70 feet down, so they train their astronauts. It's called NEMO is the name of the mission. It's NASA's Extreme Environment Mission. So they're training them both in zero gravity down there and also isolation training. They stay down there for weeks at a time and then have to go through this decompression process. But, yeah, they allowed me to interview the astronauts. So to get in, you've got to dive down, and there's a moon pool through which you can enter.
Explain that. What is a moon pool?
The moon pool is where the internal pressure of the Aquarius, it looks like a big school bus kind of at the bottom of the ocean. It's just this giant school bus looking thing where the internal pressure is equal to the water pressure down at that level. So you can just freely go in and out. There's no door necessary.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah. How long were you in the Aquarius?
I was in there for maybe a few hours. Yeah, they're in there for weeks, but it was
I don't imagine
to see
it's
the
very...
work they do and to sort of tell their story.
I don't imagine it's very big.
No, it's about, you know, there's bunks kind of the size of your studio. I'd say kind of like a school bus, pretty much the size. But the work they're doing is amazing, and I don't think people even realize, you know, what they're doing. And so it was very exciting to tell.
All right,
that's
really another program. I mean, we need to get doing that.
But now all my worlds are sort of colliding, and I never thought they would collide in this way with a show like this.
Yeah. Let's talk about American Scoreboard. But I wanted to ask first, how did you find these actors, Chris and Fran?
We've benefited from having worked in the field for a number of years now, because we also started when we were 12.
so we've all started when we were 12.
You know, the great thing about theater and the arts in general is you make a lot of friends, you make a lot of connections. And after the events in the fall, we started realizing that there were a lot of artists who wanted to find a way to give voice to what was happening in the country in a constructive way, or as I was discussing with someone, how to use their gifts, their talents, to actually engage politically.
This is not a big money project. I don't imagine we're getting scale here or anything. You're doing this out of a love of the message.
We are. We are doing this out of a love for the message. This is a nonprofit venture. And we are so thrilled to report to the listeners here that it is free and open to the public. Everybody is welcome to come. We run these about every 6 weeks. We follow the Trump administration. We consider the issues that arise, and we collect content, and then we put these up. We have only the request that you have a reservation, and to get that, you can go to americanscoreboard.com.
I'm writing that down so we can say that again at the end. .com. And that's really, it's all one word, lowercase, americanscoreboard.com. And your next production is, do you have a date, a place?
June 26th at the Players Theater at 120 Bank Street.
Mm-hmm. And we will be focusing on the congressional hearings on Russian interference in our election.
Okay, and we're going to repeat that at the end of the program. Why American Scoreboard? Where does that title come from?
Ah, very interesting. Well, I was loosely calling it the Trump Project, and Chris...
Well, we started talking about what to call this project, and, you know, it's very important that I think people understand that we're trying to do something that is not bipartisan, but it's actually nonpartisan. It's something where we encourage people from any part of the political spectrum to attend the readings and to engage in the issues. But as we were talking about what we should call this, we were trying to think of the climate that we lived in, and we realized that politics has become a sport, that people look and see that there are winners and losers. And ultimately, the losers might just be the general population. But the question is, how can we engage in a way that is devoid of ranking up scores, but actually acknowledging that that's what we're doing?
So it's a reference to the horse race, the contest, the presidential contest.
I mean, a card would actually keep scores historically of sporting events, and a scoreboard, technically and in politics over time and historically, has kept track of organization.
Mm-hmm.
Points of organization are kept track of on a scoreboard. So as Chris said, you know, keeping score is yes, part of it, and then also just the reflective nature of a scoreboard and its original tradition almost makes the series like a reflection of the administration that we're in.
Our president is very involved with scoreboards. He's always seeing him as being the winner in the scoreboard. In other words, if it's him against everyone else, he's got 100 runs and they have nothing. And I say 100 because we're coming up to the 100th days of his election. How many runs has he hit so far? If we see his baseball scoreboard, do we see runs up there?
You know what?
Next to Trump?
We work really hard to just put the material out there and not enter our opinion into it. Our biggest goal with this project is to have a safe space where everybody can come and listen to this verbatim hearing language. And we have had both Republicans and Democrats. And it's awesome because they're sitting next to somebody who does not share their viewpoint instead of being isolated in front of their phone or their laptop. And mm-hmm. I'm sure if you asked everybody in the House of the readings that we've had thus far, which revolved around healthcare and corporate fraud, and as Chris said, we're now moving into cyber intelligence, you know, they'll have a different opinion. But Alan, what do you think?
I'm going to push back against that because it's my opinion we always come to any project we have with a point of view and an attitude as much as we try to be unbiased. And I think it's a liberal problem that we have in the sense that we think there is a place that we can be neutral. I don't think there is a place like that. But so I'm going to just push against that.
And I think that's fair. But, you know, I think when we look at a question that I've asked myself now looking at the environment, and you earlier referenced the Shakespearean nature of politics right now, and I think it's a question for anyone who's producing theater, who's going to create the Shakespearean response to our political climate? And I think some people are wrestling with that. A lot of writers are. I think a lot of it is coming out as sort of political screeds or artistic screeds. For us, you know, when we say we are trying to be nonpartisan or inclusive, really what that means is we are trying to be sure that we have equal number of Republican and Democratic senators represented in the readings. We try to be sure that the arguments are seen from both sides and that we let, again, and we trust the intelligence of our audience, just like I would hope that politicians could trust the intelligence of our citizens to actually get to the meat of what is important to us as a country.
Okay. All right. Can we reveal who we voted for? Is that fair?
You know, it's so
interesting. I voted for Clinton.
Yeah, no, it's so interesting. You know, I grew up in New Hampshire. So, you know, with a state with a first primary, politics was always a part of my life. With parents who were public school teachers, they were very involved in the Democratic Party. But one of the things that I remember growing up vividly, the first time, and frankly the only time I worked on a presidential campaign up there, was doing phone calling and asking people about what was just really supposed to be pulling, what they were interested in. And it was the same time when the first nuclear power plant was opening up in New Hampshire. And people had a lot of very strong opinions. But no matter who I was calling, whether they identified as Republican or Democrat, there were a lot of shared values in that. And I say all of that to say, you know, at the end of the day, you know, who we voted for, clearly there's someone in office. The question is now, what do we do with the information and the power structure as it currently exists?
Okay.
And Chris, I so agree with you on that. And the other thing is that it's really, I feel like what you're saying is it's about listening, in a sense. I mean, now is such the time to really listen and take in information. And there's so much shouting going on. And there's so much fear out there. And so, you know, it's a great, arguably, it's a great time to sit and listen.
Shane?
Me?
Yeah.
Tracy,
yes, I'm sorry.
You know, without saying who I voted for, let me just say that it is an honor to play Elizabeth Warren, so that should probably speak for itself.
Would it be an honor to play Sarah Palin?
It would be a challenge to play Sarah Palin.
Not an honor.
Well, I would say that it's an honor to take any acting role, mostly, and especially for Fran and Chris. But the reason why it feels like an honor to play Warren is that she is a truth teller and an advocate for democracy. I'm giving myself away as to who I voted for, obviously. But
yeah.
What were you going to say?
No. I hear what Chris is saying, and I really appreciate it. And I would like to think that there is a way to get there. And I want to ask you about the reaction to the audience, but finish your thought.
Okay, well, here's what I think. I think that I get very worked up. I'm getting worked up at when we do these hearings, and I didn't know that I would. And if I were playing someone from the other, from a Republican senator or a Republican, I think it would be, I think I would be affected. I could do it. Of course I could do it. Mm-hmm. I'm an actor. Mm-hmm. But I'm very excited to play Elizabeth Warren. And to be on this side, you know, she's an advocate for democracy and she's telling the truth passionately. And I agree with her. And so it's easy for me to it's making my job much easier because I connect to this to her.
Alan, the question I would ask you or I would posit, you know, again, going back to Shakespeare, obviously we're dealing with real people and we're dealing with real issues that are affecting real lives. But, you know, would we ask an actor, you know, was it difficult to play Richard III? You know, would it be, where is the humanity? I think
you
it's
find the humanity find the in humanity. Each, in the character you're playing.
So, Tracy, you're playing Elizabeth Warren.
Yes.
Sapna, you're playing Senator Richard Craig Dick Shelby, a older white guy.
No, actually, the reading we're doing today is from the hearing of Betsy DeVos for Secretary of Education. So Sapna will be reading Betsy DeVos.
Okay, I didn't mean
Sapna
today.
Did,
what I meant
yeah.
was in the
oh,
in,
I did
in the
him.
Readings.
Yeah, I
Sorry,
played him in
you.
the Wells Fargo hearing.
Right, okay. And what was that experience of playing someone, obviously, not your age, not your race, not your ethnicity?
Right.
First of all, do you play it with a Southern accent?
No, we did. We discussed that when we were doing the readings, and we all sort of read them without the accents, with our interpretation based on those actual senators and their actual words. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting. I'm Indian. I'm an Indian woman, and so to play Senator Shelby, who's sort of an older, you know, white man from Alabama, he's the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee. It was, on a personal level, it was both fun and a challenge, taking mm-hmm. down some of those barriers, I guess, you don't even realize you put up when you're a woman, I think, sometimes. So to play that sort of chill chairman, leader character was both fun and refreshing. I think it's interesting with these readings, it's non-traditional casting, so there's women and men of all colors up there, and it kind of, I hope, drives home that point that it almost doesn't matter who's saying what, it's what's being said, the content. Who's testifying, what they're being called out on, what they're being held accountable for.
Whether it's on one side or the other.
Whether it's on one mm-hmm. side or the other. So it's really right. cool to kind of play, to have that mix.
You mm-hmm. you mentioned barriers, and I think part of the opportunity of this moment is to recognize our own barriers. And I think in me pushing back, that's what I'm trying to do, mm-hmm. is to recognize my own barriers mm-hmm. and see a way through. So some of those barriers were white male privilege. I'm trying to guess here what the barriers were that you were seeing coming through the character that you were playing.
I think the barriers for this, both with Betsy DeVos and with Richard Shelby, and really any of these senators, is having to focus on both sides, having to see both sides, whether as an actor or as a journalist. It's that same, you have to, you know, Betsy DeVos has been criticized. You've seen the montage. It's made its way around social media for a lot for not answering very eloquently and very knowledgeably on multiple subjects. But then if you're playing this role or if you're a journalist, you've got to see, okay, well, her supporters say she was an advocate for education. She's a mother. She's a grandmother. So I think the challenge has been trying to see both sides, both as an actor and a journalist. And that's been interesting.
Yeah.
That's great.
I mean, the whole question of a journalist's point of view, journalist unbiased, a journalist biased, does a journalist make a stand in some ways? It seems like the New York Times is making certain stands that it never had in the past, calling Trump to truth and justice in a way that it hasn't in the past. So this is a kind of a different way of approaching it through the actor performer who is playing Richard III and has to understand Richard III to some extent in order to play it, and has to do it truthfully and in a loving way.
I think that's very eloquently put, and that's exactly the point of this series and the goal of this series, that it's engaging and educating not only our audiences, but also the people participating in the reading.
Let's talk about the audience. Do you have a talk back afterwards? Do you have a...
No, we do not.
And why is that?
It was a very specific choice, and we discussed it a lot because Fran and I love a good talk back. But I think part of the thing, and I think as Tracy said, these readings stir up a lot of feelings for actors and for audience members. And we don't want people to feel like the experience is completed in the theater. We don't want them to have complete cathartic release. We want them to be charged to go out to discuss it with their friends after, to discuss it with other people, to keep the dialogue going well beyond our hour-long reading.
I sort of hear you. One part of me is thinking that discussion afterwards, if you were to have it, might be contentious. There might be some, in other words, you might lose whatever it is you were trying to do in the kind of throwing up of emotion that is there. And so am I right in saying you don't want to go there? You'd rather let it hang in the person's head for a while in a kind of more pure form.
Yes, Alan, you're so right. I think such a big part of being in the theater is being in the moment. And, you know, there's a magical moment in the theater when you are sitting in the seats before the show starts and the lights go down. And you have this sense of sitting with everybody in the audience, and then you have a feeling of anything can happen. And, of course, you hope that it's going to be wonderful. You know, you hope that it's going to be incredible. And so that moment when the lights go down before everything starts is really a moment of hope. And it's so easy to be scared right now. It's so easy to watch the news at night and wake up in the morning and be fearful. And I think being in the moment in the theater gives everyone a chance to just connect on what could be. What could be that's positive? And again, you know, as Chris and I mentioned, this is an opportunity to just sit and be in the moment and listen. And maybe it is very important for us to do that and walk away and meditate on what we've heard before diving in and tearing it apart mm-hmm. and throwing our opinions around. It's a thought.
I yearn, though, to hear what the audience is saying. There, after a good play, and after a play that's troubling and bothering, people talk about it. Have you kind of peeked in after a play to listen to what's being said at all? Come on, you must have.
Oh, absolutely. And I've certainly encountered, you know, the random audience member after the fact, or gone out with friends who have been at these readings, and they've become all-night discussions.
Mm-hmm. Is it the kind of discussion that you're yearning for, or is it people going back to their sides?
It's a good question. And I think it's been a little bit of both, honestly. I think some people...
I know about the taking the sides. I know that. Yeah. What is the conversation with people go... There's something else that happens. Can you remember that kind of conversation?
I really think what it's about, and it's what Sapna talked about, and what you mentioned as well, that people see a common humanity in people they might not have understood or connected with. They start to say, and I've had people say, oh, well, that ex-senator who was on the opposite party from this person actually made really good points. And that's
and I hadn't
important.
Heard that before.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
It allows people to escape the confirmation bias bubbles that we seem to find ourselves trapped in.
Okay. This is a play. It's a reading, but it's a play. Play on stage, actors, script. And I mean, it is a play. These transcripts are out there. They have been performed already. And they've been performed at a very kind of intense level. I mean, we heard the Franken-Gorsuch little piece there. And if you watch it, it's like, it's pretty intense. Just that hearing. And I'm sure that's what attracted you to this. But this stuff is out there. You can get it on YouTube. You can watch it. Why make a play out of it?
Why we put it in the theater is because of the actors. Actors know how to place language, and therefore we hear it. Some of the senators are brilliant orators, and some of them are not. And I love her, but I'm going to use her as an example. Senator Murray, who's brilliant, I feel, she prepares very well for these hearings. And yet her delivery is a little on the softer side. And when you are listening to, for instance, C-SPAN, it's not great sound. The way they handle the technical doesn't always allow what the senators are saying to be audible. And when you have such intense focus in the theater and you're listening to the actor who knows how so well to use the craft of language, mm-hmm. you hear everything and you're able to really experience it.
Okay, but if you take a Senator Murray who's subdued in delivery and now you are performing it, you're putting it into the actor's way of doing it, isn't there some interpretation that's going on, some changing, some... I mean, any actor is making choice. You're always making choices.
You're making choices, but we really encourage the actors not to comment on the text, mm-hmm. to believe that, even if it's an opinion they don't share, that this is a truth to the senator, and they're speaking from their heart, from their head. They're speaking something that they firmly believe in, and with an urgency as well. Mm-hmm. I think just to add to what Fran was saying about why in the theater, we've been very fortunate to have incredibly talented and appealing actors like Tracy and Sapna and a huge roster. You can see the incredible group of actors who've joined us on AmericanScoreboard.com. And frankly, there are people who don't watch C-SPAN who will come to hear Tracy, to hear Sapna, or to hear any of the wonderful actors, other actors who have participated in these series.
How do you make the choice of which hearings to, transcripts to perform? And what kind of editing do you do on these transcripts? I mean, you make choices because you can't do the whole thing because these things go on for hours.
We work, and it's such a good question, we work really hard to find essentially an hour to 70-minute solid chunk. A solid section of the hearing that we know.
So
we
you don't
can
edit.
Do.
You don't like take pieces and like put the. You take a chunk. You take a whole piece.
No, and frankly, in much the way of many of kind of reportage styles of theater, we spend a lot of time going back into the text, trying to capture the ahs, the ums, the reflective parts of speech that mm-hmm. actually become part of the character as well. So it's a labor-intensive process. And I'll just add, in terms of where we pick the materials, we've been focusing on those issues that seem to be headline news, but we are beginning to expand to go to both the state and local level as the arguments, as the discussions, as the difficulties start hitting the local level.
I think it's a good moment to get our actors working here. We have a scene that they're going to play for us, and maybe either Fran or Chris, you can do a little setup of the scene, and then we'll take a pause, and then we'll hear the scene. So I'm gonna hand it off to you.
Great. So this is from the confirmation hearing for Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education. It features Ms. DeVos and Senator Elizabeth Warren, and I think that's all you really need to know.
Mrs. DeVos, many of my Democratic colleagues have pointed out your lack of experience in K-12 public schools, but I would like to ask about your qualifications for leading the nation on higher education. The Department of Education is in charge of making sure that the $150 billion that we invest in students each year gets into the right hands and that students have the support they need to pay back their student loans. Now, the Secretary of Education is essentially responsible for managing a $1 trillion student loan bank and distributing $30 billion in Pell Grants to students each year. The financial futures of an entire generation of young people depend on your department getting that right. Mrs. DeVos, do you have any direct experience in running a bank?
Senator, I do not.
Uh-huh. Have you ever managed or overseen a $1 trillion loan program?
I have not.
How about a $1 billion loan program?
I have not.
Okay, so no experience in managing a program like this. How about participating in one? I think it's important for the person who's in charge of our financial aid programs to understand what it's like for students and families who are struggling to pay for college. Mrs. DeVos, have you ever taken out a student loan from the federal government to help pay for college?
I have not.
Have your children had to borrow money in order to go to college?
They have been fortunate not to.
Uh-huh. Have you had any personal experience with Pell Grant?
Well, not personal experience, but certainly friends and students with whom I have worked.
So you have no personal experience with college financial and management of higher education. Mrs. DeVos, then let's start with the basics. Do you support protecting federal taxpayer dollars from waste, fraud, and abuse?
Absolutely.
Oh, good. So do I. Because now we all know President-elect Trump's experience with higher education was to create a fake university, which resulted in his paying $25 million to students that he cheated. So I'm curious about how the Trump administration would protect against waste, fraud, and abuse at similar for-profit colleges. So here's my question. How do you plan to protect taxpayer dollars from waste, fraud, and abuse from colleges that take in millions of dollars of student aid?
Senator, if confirmed, I will certainly be very vigilant.
Yeah, I'm asking how. How will you do it? You said you're committed.
The individuals with whom I work in the department will ensure that federal monies are used properly and appropriately. I will look forward to
working
with you.
You're going to subcontract making sure what happened with universities that cheat students don't happen anymore?
No, I didn't say.
You're going to give that to someone else to do? I just want to know what your ideas are for making sure we don't have problems with waste, fraud, and abuse.
I want to make sure we don't have problems with that as well. And if confirmed, I will work diligently to ensure that we are addressing any of those issues.
Okay, let me make a suggestion on this. It actually turns out that there are a whole group of rules that are already written and are there. And all you have to do is enforce them. So what I want to know is, will you commit to enforcing these rules to ensure that no career college receives federal funds unless they can prove they are actually preparing their students for gainful employment and not cheating them?
Senator, I will commit to ensuring that institutions that receive federal funds are serving their students well.
And so you will enforce the gainful employment rule to ensure that these career colleges are not cheating students?
We will certainly review that rule.
I don't understand about reviewing it. We talked about this in my office. There are already rules in place to stop waste, fraud, and abuse, and I don't understand how you cannot be sure about enforcing them. You know, swindlers and crooks are out there doing backflips when they hear an answer like this. If confirmed, you will be the cop on the beat. And if you cannot commit to use the tools that are already available to you in the Department of Education, then I don't see how you could be the Secretary of Education. And I look forward to having a second round of questions.
Thank you. That was thrilling. I see why people would want to come in and see this. The rhythm, the pauses, the thinking. It's reproduced, but it seems to be more than just reproduced. I wanted to get to what is the extra that we're getting here that we don't get if we were to watch the hearing. We are getting something extra here. It's thrilling, right? But it's theater. What is it that theater is adding to this piece that we're not getting when we watch the video of it?
It's such a good question. You know, I think we all go to the theater to capture that ineffable truth, that moment of connected humanity. The reason why we have many different people, women playing men playing women, people of many different cultural backgrounds reading these senators, is they're giving voice to us as a country, and we are a country of great diversity. And I think that becomes immediate when you hear great actors reading this text, that there's a truth, that there's a common bond beyond just the politics that separate us.
Yeah. And Alan, also, sometimes we just can't describe it, and we just can't put our finger on it. Mm-hmm. There is something about the theater that just is magic, and you just have to be there to feel it.
Let me throw out a posit something, posit an idea. When you see it on the television screen or in your what I call your mini-me's on your small screens, there is a kind of a coldness about it. There's kind of a separation about it. There's almost an inhumanity about it. There is an us and them kind of quality to it. When I was sitting here listening and when watching you, it's like I was feeling for both of you. Mm-hmm. I was feeling for the person, Voss, the character DeVos, who was struggling with something that she's going to be struggling with now for a while, and but I was seeing it through Sapna. I was seeing it through you as an actor. So I couldn't see. I was seeing DeVos and Sapna at the same time. Mm. So it's the actor and the character kind of like coming together here and making something new. Is there anything there?
I think that's really a great way of putting it. It's that immediate empathic or empathetic connection with another human being who is sharing the same moment in time, sharing the same breath, the same air. And you really are hearing the words and not just the ideas.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The actors, what are you feeling while you're doing that? Because you've seen these transcripts. Obviously, you've studied them. You've studied the transcripts, but you've also studied the video. You've probably looked at the video. How is this feel different to you than when you were watching it on a screen? I know it feels like a play, right?
It's an experience.
You became Warren. I mean, mm-hmm. But it wasn't Warren. It was you mm-hmm. as Warren.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I, I'm sure Sapna can also relate to this. I start to feel, for instance, Warren has a great deal of energy and passion, and mm-hmm. so do I. Mm-hmm. And so I, and that's exciting. You know, I'm it's like a meld of both, and I can imagine that playing DeVos, because I can feel it coming from you. There's a, I felt for you. In this reading, I felt for you. When I watched this on C-SPAN, and yes, I did look at it, pardon me, but Mrs. DeVos comes off very sarcastic and, you know.
Snarky?
Snarky, yes, and not so here. We get the humanity. So I come away from this reading feeling full, very full and I'm not as eloquent as some other people here, but yeah. I feel you struggle, yeah. And yeah. So it's
there's something happens to when an actor, the wonderfulness of acting, it's beyond just entertainment. It's beyond, you know, it's beyond anything that you know, good feeling. It's something that's essentially human to me. I one time tried to be an actor and it just didn't work out. But it's that translation of real life, I'm putting air quotes out, of real life into a performance, theater performance, not even a film performance, because I think this can only happen on the stage. I don't know if we want to kind of delve into that anymore or talk about it, but it's different. And anyone out there who's listening to this, you should really have that experience of these actors going through this trance. And I know the thought. It is, it's making me see these Trumpish people who I'm so angry with, they're people. And
you can see them as yeah. people and still not agree with them. Yeah. And that's an important distinction. We're not trying to humanize or dehumanize anyone involved in this. We are just trying to let people realize we're all in this, like it or not. Mm-hmm. So how do we figure it out together?
How do we keep moving? Talking about keeping moving forward, what's the future of American Scoreboard? Where are you going with it? I know you're going to be at the, I wrote it down here somewhere. You can tell us. At the June 26th at the Players Theater, 120 Bank Street.
Yes, we will be doing the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing on cyber measures in regard to WikiLeaks and Russian interference in the election. And the kingpin figure in that hearing is Clint Watts, who's a security expert throughout that hearing with the senators. We have tackled corporate fraud with the Wells Fargo hearing at the, right after the election. We addressed healthcare with the Tom Price confirmation hearing. We are working on immigration. We are working on
the
every
full
DeVos. And the full DeVos, which we will have September 25th at Pace University in collaboration producing with them at the Michael Schimmel Center.
But it will not be called the full DeVos because that sounds like...
it sounds like it sounds critical.
The full Monty.
The full Monty, right?
Exactly.
And are you all, I'm talking to the actors now, are you going to be sticking with this? Or is this something that you're going to continue to do? Do you have a troupe of actors?
So. I, as long as they're asking, I'm there.
Yeah. Awesome.
Great.
Great.
That's great.
And these readings involve anywhere from 10 to 20 different actors. So audiences attending really do get to see a great range of New York talent. So we encourage you to come out.
And it's free.
And it's free.
How are you funded? That's my last question.
Oh, you know, nonprofit fundraising. You go through all the different sectors and you line up all the pennies you can,
yeah.
Right? So it's...
Does the New York Foundation help at all?
Foundation for the Arts?
Yeah.
Nope, I don't believe we've been in existence long enough to hit one of their cycles.
Okay.
But
all
we
right.
will.
All right, you will. American Scoreboard is coming to you at local New York theaters. Next production, June 26th at the Players Theater at 120 Bank Street. It's been a pleasure talking to all of you. I want to hear more of this. This is fascinating stuff. I want to thank you for being here on Radio 568. This is our Play Talk edition. You can contact us at Radio568JJ on Twitter, our president's favorite way of communicating. Just contact us at, I forgot what we are. We're Radio568JJ on Twitter. Please contact us. And thank you so much for joining us. And boy, I'm really looking forward to getting out there to Bank Street on June 26th at 8 o'clock.
7 o'clock.
7 o'clock. There we go. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Alan.
Thank you, Alan.
Thank you.